Wind is from the south at 6, humidity 81%. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. Their doors may be closed right now, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackanddrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And in this portion of WGTD's morning show, we're going to be talking about the very important connection between our brain and the food we eat. This is a connection that is of paramount importance, and it can certainly make a tremendous difference in our own mental and emotional well-being, as well as, of course, our physical well-being. And this is something that has been explored for some time by my morning show guest, Dr. Uma Naidu, who is a board-certified psychiatrist, nutrition specialist, and professional chef. And she is the director of nutritional and lifestyle psychiatry at Massachusetts General Hospital, the first clinic of its kind in the United States, where, among other things, she consults on nutritional interventions for people who are psychiatrically and or medically ill. So she has, over the course of her life and her professional study and exploration, has come to understand the connection between brain and gut, between what our life is like mentally and emotionally with the foods that we consume. And she has outlined all of this in a brand new book published by Little Brown Spark called This Is Your Brain on Food, an indispensable guide to the surprising foods that fight depression, anxiety, PTSD, OCD, ADHD, and more. Dr. Uma Naidu, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much, Greg. It's lovely to be here.
I appreciate the fact that although your book is very much scientifically based, that there is plenty of personal that is in this book as well. And one of the things that you tell us is that for someone who cares so much about the food we eat and the effect that the food we eat has on us physically and mentally, that you are somebody, although you are a very able professional chef now, you actually started to cook relatively late in life. Explain to our listeners why this proved to be the case.
That's a good one, Greg. I grew up in a very large Indian family or South Asian family in South Africa, and was surrounded by aunts, grandmothers, cousins who are older than me that cooked, and there was a need for me to cook. So I would hang around the kitchen, around the delicious tastes and smells, and my family was also a very large number of physicians. So there was always also a focus on nutrition and good eating, but delicious food. When I moved to Boston to study, it was quite far away. And when I began my journey at Harvard, the one thing I could bring with me were my mom's spices and recipes. And that helped me get through residency in terms of learning to cook. So I would very frequently be asking questions, but I discovered that unlike a chore that cooking can sometimes be, I really looked forward to it so much that it became my space for mindfulness and stress relief at the end of a very busy day of studying or working. And I carry that forward into residency. In residency, I started to talk to my patients as I was prescribing medications and really became part of the language I began to use. But that is how I grew to cook very late in life.
Hmm. While we're talking about the personal, I want to give you a chance to talk about one of the people to whom you dedicate the book, someone whom you refer to affectionately as Pinetown Granny, your maternal grandmother. Explain to our listeners the important role that she played in your early life, and in particular when it came to your own understanding of and appreciation of good and healthy food.
Absolutely. My mom, starts off with my mom and my dad. My mom is a double boarded physician, and I was born while she was in medical school. So during the day, I was cared for by my maternal grandmother, Pinetown Granny. And Pinetown is actually the suburb of the town, you know, that where she lived. So we would just refer to her that, but of course I had more affectionate terms that I would use for her. But she was, we would get up in the morning, or when I was dropped off, I should say, and we would pick freshly grown vegetables in the garden and decide together what she was going to prepare. And I was little, so I wasn't allowed inside the kitchen, but I could stand at the door and talk to her about what she was making, what she was using, why she was using the healthy spices that she was using, and how she was preparing. So we'd have this dialogue around food. And so I learned at an early age that, you know, freshly picked vegetables being prepared or whatever else she was cooking were things that were almost inherent to how I understood food. And she, of course, was a very meaningful person in my life because I spent my daytime with her. And at the end of a busy day of studying, my mom would pick me up and take me home to stay with the rest of my family. So Pinetown Granny was a very big part of my life.
One other personal matter that I want to be sure to ask you about, and you talk about it in your book, is the fact that you are a cancer survivor, and that some of what you came to understand about the connection between our mental and emotional and physical well-being and the food we eat was really brought home to you in a very big way as you underwent the gauntlet of chemotherapy. As your cancer was treated. Tell our listeners, at least in brief, some of what you learned or what this experience confirmed for you in terms of what you already understood to be true about the importance of the food we eat.
You know, I was in a large amount of shock when I was diagnosed, at least for the first week. And partly because it happened suddenly, I was feeling otherwise healthy. So here's a shout out to always get your mammogram. And I also was blessed by the fact that I live in Boston and have access to premium medical care. I feel very fortunate for that. And because of that, I was diagnosed fully and began treatment in a very short period of time. So it's almost as though my mind and my brain hadn't really caught up with the rest of my body. And on the day that I began my first treatment, I was fearful. I was anxious. I was having my morning cup of turmeric tea with a pinch of black pepper and the thing that I, you know, the little blend I use at home, and thinking through all the side effects I knew of the medications I was about to face, and realized that, you know, I sort of thought to myself, I'm facing this. Why am I not thinking the way that I do when I talk to my other patients? It's obviously very different when you're the patient. And something sort of clicked in as I was really was boiling the water for my tea and the kettle shut off. And the thing that happened was I realized I should be doing what I tell my patients to do. Now, that being said, Greg, of course, I was trying to eat a healthy diet and trying to follow all of that. But when I say that I was feeling so anxious, I realized the way that I can help myself is through how I eat today. And that led to a very big change in how I approached my treatment and my diagnosis. Once I kind of got through that shock, and I just started to prepare my meals in a particular way, really focus on anxiety, foods that will quell anxiety, really started to think more about how to further fortify my gut microbiome by how I ate. And that was a significant change, moving from shock to kicking in to the fact that, you know, I could actually practice this in a much more elevated way myself because I was now ill.
Hmm. We're speaking with Dr. Uma Naidu about her new book, This Is Your Brain on Food. She is Director of Nutritional and Lifestyle Psychiatry at Massachusetts General Hospital. So one of the interesting points that is made in your book is that in recent years, the connection between the brain and the gut, between our mental and emotional well-being and the food we consume, that connection more recently was, in a sense, interrupted, but that once upon a time, in the 18th and 19th centuries, at least many doctors had a fairly decent understanding of how our body's systems are connected, and that, for instance, our digestive system and our nervous system have a connectedness that at some point in the late 19th century and into the 20th century was largely abandoned or ignored or forgotten. Can you just explain why that connection was lost at that point in time, a connection which now we are beginning to, in a sense, regain or reconnect?
Sure. You know, I'm not 100% sure that it was entirely lost. I think that individuals who were really researching gut microbiome and those connections continued. I think that the way I would probably think about it for the work that I do is that we didn't make that linkage between food and the brain and the connection through the gut-brain axis until, I would say, more recently, in the sense that people know and doctors know how to counsel their patients about how to eat for hypertension, for obesity, for diabetes, for high cholesterol, but we really don't talk to our patients about how you can eat for better mental health. And as I began to sort of uncover these connections through my clinical work and really understanding, reading, and learning nutrition, what I found was that there was more, as I uncovered it, there was actually really good research on the gut microbiome that existed in mental health as well, in the sense that studies were being done that connected the impacts of food, which we outline in the book, with, you know, emotional states. But no one was really having this conversation. And I think that was the change that I made early on in how I began to work with patients. So I think that the research was going on, but it might have been more related to gastrointestinal conditions and things like that.
One of the points that you make in your book is that this connection between the body's nervous system and our digestive system is not just something that we sort of imagine is there or believe is there, but it is actually a connection that, to at least some extent, is a physical connection. I mean, there's an actual physical connection that, in a sense, one could actually see if you were able to look into the body. It is not a theoretical sort of connection. Explain what that actual physical connection is.
Exactly. So from whence we were born and as our organs developed, even as we were each a fetus, what happens is that there's a nervous system that develops in our body. And one very specific major cranial nerve is the vagus nerve. And the vagus nerve extends in many different ways in the body, but it connects directly, anatomically, physiologically, biochemically, the gut to the brain. It is a direct link. So you're absolutely right, Greg. It is not imagined. It's not something that's theoretical. It physically exists in our bodies. And I think what's helpful for people who are thinking about mental well-being, because I will point out that, you know, the what I speak about in the book, we divided by diagnoses, but there are many people who don't fit into diagnosis. And I think that it's helpful for those who are just seeking, especially in current times, to feel better emotionally, can actually use the suggestions to, in a preventative way, to really fortify their gut-brain connection by how they eat. And one of the reasons that's really important is that serotonin is known as the happiness hormone, and serotonin is the is in medications, formulated in the medications that are prescribed for depression and anxiety and other mental health conditions. So things like fluoxetine or Prozac are selected serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Well, more than 90% of the serotonin receptors are located in the gut. So when you think about it, if what you're eating is being metabolized and digested and going through different processes in your gut and the serotonin receptors are right there, that also provides for you that important physical connection.
One of the most interesting moments in the book is when you talk about how this connection between the gut and the brain is a delicate system, as in all delicate systems, things can go wrong. And I think we don't always stop to think about the way our bodies are put together as delicate. I mean, we might think of ourselves as delicate when we fall down and we break our wrist or something, but
right.
I think by and large, we think of the body when it's working normally or working well, that it's, you know, fairly kind of robust and
mm-hmm. strong.
Yeah, yeah, and it all kind of makes sense. But to describe the body as a delicate system, and in particular this connection between the nervous system and the digestive system, points to something that is I think really important in what you're talking about. Because then, if we are making poor choices in what we are taking into our body, then it's no wonder that this delicate system is going to be adversely affected. What are some of the ways in which that is occurs most commonly?
That's a great point, Greg, and I appreciate that you picked up on that, simply because a lot of individuals feel like when doctors make recommendations about healthy eating, that they are, you know, that every doctor says the same thing. And in fact, we do. It is in fact true. However, I think the connection that we need to understand is that when we're making certain recommendations, they go to impact how food is metabolized by our body. So if we were eating a diet of pizza, ice cream, potato chips, and processed foods, which contain dyes, stabilizers, food preservatives, and often quite a lot of sodium and added sugar, then that's how our body is being built. And the standard American diet, which, you know, people call the SAD diet, is in fact sad, because most of us, or many of us, I should say, while we might be trying to embrace a healthier lifestyle, often struggle with these things. And I say that as part of that group. I don't think any one of us is perfect. We're all on a journey. But when we feed our bodies with the wrong types of fats, with trans fats, which have been linked in studies to actually increase aggression in individuals, with high levels of preservatives from processed foods, with added sugars, and those types of ingredients, then we are not doing our body, but most importantly, we also not doing our brain and our emotional health any good. Those foods just drive processes such as inflammation in the gut, which ends up with conditions such as leaky gut over time, and that imbalance in our gut microbiome can also lead to mental health conditions. So, you know, it becomes more important than just eat your leafy greens, because while we might say that, there's also a burgeoning amount of research around the content of certain greens and vegetables and fruit that are really healthy for our gut. So a healthy whole foods balanced diet that includes sources of fiber, which you only get from fruit, vegetables, beans, nuts, legumes, and seeds. You cannot get it from animal or seafood proteins. It's very important. So it's more than just eat your salad or eat your greens. There are many different nutrients in these types of food that we discuss in the book, which are really meant to help help people understand the real connection and not just the glib statements that doctors might sometimes make, that we are saying it for a reason. There are real reasons that this will fortify your gut versus eating a diet of pizza and ice cream. And I'm all for people having a treat day in the week, not a cheat day. Cheat day makes us psychologically feel like we're hiding or eating something bad. But treat day of whether it is pizza and ice cream that you enjoy, you know, have that on your night off or special night of the week for you. But don't overeat. Eat it with, you know, portion control. Enjoy it, savor it. But then the rest of the week, try to embrace the healthy habits, because that form of balance will really get you towards a better sense of mental well-being. It'll fortify your mental health and your gut microbiome if, in fact, you're otherwise doing okay, but you want to continue to feel that way. And if you're not feeling good, say you're anxious, stressed, you know, mildly depressed, or whatever the symptoms might be, it will also help you.
And we should say that your book includes chapters devoted to things like depression, anxiety, PTSD, ADHD, and more, in which you spell out specific suggestions on what people might eat to make a positive difference if those are issues with which they are contending. I really appreciated a point you made in the book that I think is of paramount importance and yet something we don't really stop to think about. You write at one point, a dearth of good dietary choices leads to an increase in mental health issues, and mental health issues in turn lead to poor eating habits. I had never stopped to think about the vicious cycle that we are often talking about here, in which we get ourselves into mental or emotional trouble because of what we are eating, and then those mental and emotional troubles in a sense, deepen the pit in which we find ourselves because we make increasingly poor eating habits. And I should think that breaking that harmful cycle is probably an indispensable part of helping somebody recover from some of these issues.
Absolutely. You know, everyone who may have been diagnosed with an actual mental illness or anyone suffering from just not feeling particularly well in any one of the domains that we discuss and you just mentioned, could start to feel better through embracing a better diet. Some people start from a different baseline, Greg. You know, some people have, it's not only food that causes these problems. They may have genetic, other socioeconomic, or many other factors, trauma, or many things that drive how they're feeling emotionally. But here's the thing. Food is something we all have to do. We all have to do it anyway. And my mantra is, why not do it well on most days of the week so that you are really embracing better food choices that will fortify your mental health, prevent the onset or worsening of mental conditions, and really overall, and importantly, also help your physical health. I think that, you know, the physical health connection, like I said at the beginning of our conversation, people know about. They know that they shouldn't be eating a certain food because of high cholesterol, but they don't really make those associations with mental health. And I think especially now where we are stressed in many different ways and feeling, the American Psychiatric Association did a survey very early on in COVID, which showed that one of the things amongst all the different conditions that were worsening, one of the things that people were most concerned about was uncertainty. And I think that where we are so uncertain about so many things moving forward, one way we can help ourselves is just use this time to maybe reset how we're eating on most days of the week.
Briefly, can you explain why bacteria is such an important factor in all of this? That's something we often don't stop to think about when we're thinking about choosing the right foods. In what way is bacteria a major player here?
Sure. So a gut microbiome actually contains approximately 39 trillion different bugs, let's call them, because they're not just bacteria. They're different types of bugs. And those are part of what we call the gut microbiome. They can either, Greg, work for us or against us. They simply, they live there, they help with, you know, the regulation of different body systems, including the immune system, including, you know, what we talked about in terms of mental well-being. And when you eat poorly, you basically feed the bad bugs in your gut. And the bad bugs take over and they start to cause disease. And one of the mechanisms of the different mechanisms is through inflammation. If you eat well on most days of the week and you are, you know, embracing healthy whole foods, my other mantra is eat the orange, skip the orange juice. The orange juice loses its fiber, has tons of added sugar. But if you eat the whole fruit or you eating healthy whole foods, including plants, vegetables, lean proteins, and healthy sources of fat, such as olive oil, for example, you are starting to embrace a healthier diet. When you do that, those bugs in the gut that are good bugs will thrive. And fiber is one of the very important foods that they need. Fiber is obtained from, it cannot be obtained from animal or seafood proteins, and can be obtained from fruit, vegetables, beans, nuts, seeds, legumes, and healthy whole grains. So just by doing simple things, it could be one simple thing that you change in your diet today, you will then helping those good bacteria thrive. And the balance of the good bugs and the bad bugs is critical to our physical and mental health.
A last quick question. How difficult is it to know what difference is being made in the body by the food we're eating versus other choices that we make in terms of our lifestyle? And of course, this is something you've studied and you are director and founder of the Nutritional and Lifestyle Psychiatry Center. So these are obviously intertwined. Is it sometimes hard to know what is being affected by food versus what is being affected by other things like exercise or sleep or whatever?
So I think, again, you know, I think the lifestyle factors are hugely important. My book is really written about the food, but my model of care in nutritional psychiatry is really a holistic, integrated functional approach to psychiatry. And what I mean by that is mind-body connections, sources of mindfulness, using, you know, relaxation techniques to help with anxiety, wondering about sleep hygiene, adequate hydration, proper exercise and movement. Many of these, in fact, all of them, including things like yoga, have all been brought through research to show positive connections to mental health when done well. So all of those factors are very important in how I work with any individual on a nutritional psychiatry treatment plan. What we highlighted in the book was really the food, because that we felt was something that people could start to do immediately. And we also know that, you know, we generally as a nation don't eat that well and would be a good place to start. But you're absolutely right. All of those measures are extremely important. How do we know? With food, it's usually that inflammation gets set up in the body, and that someone, for example, a young executive I treated who had gotten this wonderful promotion at work, you know, came to me with new onset anxiety, thinking she needed a medication. But it turned out over about 18 months, due to the promotion, she was flying a lot, traveling, eating in airports, eating in the snacks in the bar fridge at the hotels, not eating home food or home cooked meals any longer because of this promotion. And over time, it impacted her gut microbiome. The bad bugs kind of took over. She had a significant amount of inflammation. And the way that it presented was with extreme panic attacks that were new to her. But when we really uncovered what we needed to do, it was helping her embrace her healthier diet that she'd been eating before she became ill.
Your book, of course, is chock full of other similar sorts of stories, and again, lots of very specific information about the kind of foods that we can eat to make a very significant difference in various issues with which we might be contending. The book, again, is titled, This is Your Brain on Food, An Indispensable Guide to the Surprising Foods That Fight Depression, Anxiety, PTSD, OCD, ADHD, and more, published by Little Brown Spark, the author, Dr. Uma Naidu. Dr. Naidu, it has been a great pleasure for me to speak with you on the morning show. Thank you for giving the world this fascinating book, and best wishes to you.
Thank you so much, Greg. It was a pleasure to talk with you. I really enjoyed it.
You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Now an interview from the Morning Show archive, which was recorded and originally broadcast back in 2009. I have just finished reading one of the most unforgettable, harrowing memoirs I have ever read, called What's Left of Us, a memoir of addiction. written by Richard Farrell, who is gifted in so many ways, a filmmaker, teacher, journalist, of course, author, an adjunct professor of English at the University of Massachusetts in Lowell. And perhaps you have seen his highly acclaimed documentary, High on Crack Street. And he joins us today from the trailer of a film set to talk about this memoir and the experience of what it was like for him to look back at some of the most painful, self-destructive chapters in his life as he battled a severe addiction to heroin, which occurred at least in some part as a reaction to some of the real deep pain which he experienced in his childhood. And it is all here in the pages of this incredible book published by Citadel Press, again called What's Left of Us. And I'm very honored to be able to speak with Richard Farrell for the next few minutes about this remarkable book. Richard Farrell, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
Tell us what film set you're on right now, exactly what's going on, and with the understanding that at any moment pressing matters on this film might take you away from the interview.
That's right. We're just waiting to get the call from the ADs when we got to go back. Hopefully I'll be here for a while. I'm up on the set of The Fighter, which is being filmed in Lowell, Massachusetts. It's starring Mark Wahlberg and Christian Bale. And it is based partially on a HBO documentary film I did called High on Crack Street, where I followed three crack addicts for 18 months. One of those crack addicts was Dickie Eklund, who was a world-class fighter, fought Sugar Ray Leonard. Actually, I was yesterday in scenes all day with Sugar Ray Leonard. Me and him, it was great. But he fought Sugar Ray Leonard, went the distance, and lost. He could have been a champion, lost his career to drugs. Well, during the filming of High on Crack Street, his younger brother, Mickey Ward, his half-brother, was coming up. And he was on his way as a fighter, and Dickie went to jail during our film. Mickey went on, and this movie is about Dickie getting out of jail and the two of them, Mickey and Dickie, putting their demons down long enough to become champions of the world. And Mickey Ward fought three unbelievable fights with Otero Gatti, who just died the other day, tragically. But so I'm here in this unbelievable, surreal setting, playing myself, Richie Farrell, in the movie The Fighter. It's amazing.
Well, and you're one of the screenwriters of the film too, if I understand my memory.
I worked on this film for 2.5 years. Darren Aronofsky and Scott Silva. Of course, we all know Darren. He was the director of The Wrestler, and Scott Silva wrote 8 Mile. They called me up and said, "Richie, we want you on this film." Went and met them, and I've started working on it April 1st, 2007, which was actually my birthday. I was 20 years straight at that time. And for the past 2.5 years, Scott and I have kicked around this script, and here we are shooting it.
Wow. An amazing thing, and essentially in your own backyard.
Unbelievable. I don't live there anymore, but, you know, funny thing is, I was driving down this morning to be for an 8 a.m. call, and I said, "This is surreal. I see the smoke tower that's still up. The mill has been torn down. I see the smoke tower still up." And I said, "Wow, 22 years ago, I attempted suicide in that mill right there. And we're about a football field away filming." It's been an incredible story. You know, I got straight. 5 years later, came back to Lowell to make Crack Street. You know, went on to with my career and wrote, you know, other stuff. And then worked on the screenplay while I was writing my memoir. And here I am playing myself. It's just a complete circle.
One of the nuggets of wisdom among many in this book is at one point when you essentially put to rest what for you is the incorrect myth that time heals everything. You said your dad always told you time would heal everything, but you say flat out he's wrong. I mean, in a sense, your book is about how it takes a whole lot more than time to heal some of the deep wounds which someone like yourself has experienced in life. And for you, actually, the healing of these many wounds and the healing of your addiction was something that came from all sides. Untangle for us just what it was that allowed you to finally step away from your life of addiction.
You know, it's amazing. I'm asked that all the time in interviews, and I still don't have an answer. For years and years, I suffered with survivor's guilt. Why me? Why are all my friends dead? I just couldn't put it all together. And I just, you know, when I said I don't want to live like this anymore, and I had two small boys, I just burnt our house down. My wife at the time was living with my mom, you know, and I just said, I think my kids will be better off with someone else raising, not this junkie on the street. And when I lived, something happened to me. And, of course, the memoir is told from that 28-year-old junkie in rehab and detox, the 7 days in detox. So, you know, and then I get out. Something caught to me there. Something spiritual happened to me. It says, I didn't die, so there's a reason for this. And I just kept going one day at a time, one day at a time, and all of a sudden the ones added up to 22 years, you know. So I don't really know, but regardless of where my career took me, and it took me on many paths from I became a journalist, covered the war in Bosnia, worked at HBO, wrote another bestseller, you know, just worked on this script. And no, it regardless where it brought me, those ghosts from my past hunted me down. It would haunt me.
Hmm.
And I knew that I had to go back in to this darkness to write it. And on July 1st, when it came out on my book party signing, it was like I cried, just cried and cried. It was finally gone. I had finally made peace with myself.
Hmm.
It was over.
Your childhood was incredibly difficult for a couple of different reasons. One of them was because of the physical condition in which you were born. And in a sense, what that did to your own father's dreams for who you were going to be. Tell us about the circumstances surrounding your birth and that difficulty and the difficulties which sprang from that.
Yeah, that's what happened. I was born with what they thought, cerebral palsy. I didn't walk, and I was a breech burst. The loss of oxygen destroyed a section of my brain. My father, no way, good Irish Catholic, you know, wounded veteran in Korea, said no way I'm going to have a crippled son. He found a neurologist at the VA hospital who said, hey, listen, that part of his brain is dead, so it's not sending signals to his right arm or his right leg. So what you have to do, you have to become his brain. You have to put him on the floor every single morning and night, and you've got to rip and stretch that leg straight so the muscles won't atrophy. And he was determined to do this. They tell me it was pretty awful that I was, you know, a young baby screaming and crying as he's ripping at me. But he succeeded. He succeeded. I was a football star in high school and, you know, had colleges looking at me. His goal was to have me play for Notre Dame. And when my chop block ended everything, I fell in love with Perkin Ann after my first knee operation, and my father disowned me. And it wasn't until I started having kids that my father came back into my life. And then, of course, tragically, my mother was in the hospital having a hysterectomy, and my father wasn't responding to the phone call. He called me. I went to the house. As soon as I pulled up the driveway, I saw the maroon Monte Carlo there. I knew something was wrong. I knew something was going on, I mean, because everybody knew my father was having an affair with this former student that he was teaching English to. And there they were on the ground doing their thing in the heat of passion. She saw me first, and I just completely wigged out, threw her out the back porch. She went down and my father was on the ground, and I pulled a chair up next to him, a kitchen chair. And he had a habit of doing the, the Red Fox routine. Elizabeth, I'm coming, grabbing his chest like he was having a heart attack. And, I didn't go for it. I just said, you know, you hypocrite. All this mass and communion every day, all this stuff, mums in the hall. I just sat there talking to him. I don't know how long. I've been trying to figure it out for years and years, but all of a sudden his lips started to swell and get blue. And I realized that he wasn't faking. I ran down the hall, grabbed a bottle of nitro on his bureau, came back. The bottle went, you know, I thought the cap was closed. I went to push down. It was open. It went all over the place. Grabbed a couple, tried to get it under his tongue, but he died right there in my arms. And that night at the hospital, when I went to the hospital, I had a guy meet me. There was a heroin addict Never shot drugs before. I wasn't into needles. And he shot a bag of heroin into my left arm. I went upstairs on the fifth floor of the same hospital my father was pronounced dead on. Went upstairs, and I told my mom that my father had died.
You had specifically sought out heroin because you couldn't think of another way to absorb this pain and guilt and trauma. And unfortunately, that first shot of heroin led to many more after that. Part of this story is of how your father was in so many respects or at so many points in time brutal to you. And when you were so hungry for his love and approval, at one point in talking to your counselor at detox, you say, there was only one thing I ever truly wanted in my life. I wanted my dad to be proud of me, and I would have done anything to accomplish it. Talk a moment more about that terrible hunger, which, of course, so many children have to be loved and admired by their parents, and something which for you proved to be quite elusive.
Right, and that's the biggest thing out of him dying in my arms. It was over right then. All I wanted him to do was to love me for who I was, and I was constantly striving for that, so it was over. There was nothing I could do, and heroin was the only thing that would kill that emotional pain that I killed the guy that I loved, that I wanted him to love me, and he'll never have an opportunity again. And you know, I wrote this op-ed piece, Father's Day piece, right in June. It was in the L.A. Times, and you know, I tell a story about how brutal he was to me, and I talk about my 13th birthday, how he had a birthday party, for a big party. When everybody left, he took one present downstairs, unwrapped a set of boxing gloves. And he continued to just beat me from one end of the playroom to the other end of the playroom. I collapsed in his arms, crying. And, you know, he said, I did this for you to make you strong. You're going to need this. So, I mean, I have tons of those brutality. You know, he was brutal. But then I remember going to trial for the Little League, and I was the only kid that didn't make it. And I use this in the story, the juxtaposition. And he was there on the tryouts, and you know, people would see me running, and people would see me running, and they were laughing, sticking. I saw my father. See that, Mickey? I'm a star. I'm sorry about that, Mickey.
Okay.
Ward, the fight is. Sorry, Mick. You know, and he was, you know, he was. Oh, there's my shirt. So. One star. You get two stars. All right, thanks. Hey, buddy, how you doing? Thanks, brother. I'll see you. That's Mickey Ward, who the fighter is about, the real Mickey Ward.
Wow.
You know, the thing is, he saw me cry when I'd try and get the ground balls and run up to him. The kids would be snickering at the way I ran and throw, and we both strolled back in the car. Silently, you know, and I was crying. I looked over, he was crying, and he just reached over and grabbed my hand, you know. And the next day, he walked up the hill to Richard K. Donahue, who was JFK's advisor in Washington, and to Paul Tsongas. He walked around and he got sponsorship, went to a local sporting goods store and had them front all kinds of uniforms and equipment. He started the Shed Park Minor League. So that every kid would play, and it's still going today. So, you know, and so you see the juxtaposition of that love, how he brutally, for what he thought, he was loving me by making me strong. And so I just never could get him to love me the way I want, just for being me.
Right. One of the things that you wonder about on the pages of this memoir is a little bit about how you survived and your brother Sean and your mother, how you could survive life in a house like this. And you pose this question: how would Mom continue without the madness in her life? I know it's crazy, but after a while, you thrive inside turmoil.
Yeah.
Would you say that was true of you as well, that in fact did some of these, the horrific way in which your father treated you, was was there some ways in which you managed to thrive in that turmoil, or for you was the cost very different?
No, it's ironic. My father, the madness that I grew up in, gave me the basis to survive everything I do in my life. Everything. It doesn't matter. What my father did to me actually gave me the courage and the discipline to thrive and in turmoil. When it's against the wall, when it's the rubber meets the road, when it's time to perform, I'm there. There's nothing. And it's, I see my father. I hear my father. There's just no stopping. And so that's the ironic thing. I thrive now because of what my father did to me. Way back when I was young.
That is an awful irony, isn't it? One of the most terrible things you describe is a punishment your father rendered, in which, with duct tape, he secured your arms and your legs and taped over your mouth and your nose. You could scarcely breathe, and taped over your eyes, and then went at you with an electric carving knife. I mean, not stabbing you, but threatening to do so. And you talk of that horrible humming, and I mean the unbelievable terror which this caused in you. And then he tells you, you're too young to understand, but I did this for your own good. This will protect you. I mean, this was your father's twisted way of trying to be an attentive father to you. I mean, we could scarcely imagine such a thing.
Yeah, when I urinated off the sound, I was so, you know, I just you know, hysterical. I couldn't see. I heard it coming. I mean, he caught me hitchhiking. And the next thing I know, I was going there, and you know, I was completely hysterical. I urinated all over myself, and it was just like he said to me, he did it for me, because if the boogeyman had caught me, what happened? Do we got to go, brother?
Yes. Sure.
Okay. I'll be right there. All right. So, he said to me, I did it for you. I did it for you, because if the boogeyman had got, if a bad guy had got you thumbing, this was what they could have done to you.
Can we take one more minute?
Yeah, we have one more minute.
Okay.
Sure.
You most of the book, the framework is of these 7 days which you spend in detox, 7 days right, which for you make a real difference. Among the many things we learn in that book is how it was amazing for you to see the common ground between you and the others who were there. I mean, in a sense, something like a heroin addiction is a great leveler. I mean, it plays no favorites. And this was something that you were caught in, and some escaped and others did not.
That's right. That's right. I was one of the lucky ones. I don't know why I escaped it, but I think for right now, you know, I'm looking at my partner here that's playing the HBO producer here, a great guy, and we talked all day yesterday, and it's like, you know, this is surreal. I escaped it. My friends did it. Heroin is a drug that I took once. People say, what do you mean you took it once? When I'm talking to Keith, you took it once? I said, yes, I took it once. And after that, heroin took me to any place it wanted to. So I wrote my book not to glamorize addiction like a lot of these memoirs are. I want kids and fathers and potential fathers to read this and say, this is hell, man. You don't want to go this, because only 3% of the people make it back. So I didn't write this as a 50-year-old guy looking back in perspective. I wrote it as a 28-year-old madman junkie. I went back into that evil to show people what it was, and I hope everybody reads it.
The book is What's Left of Us. Richard Farrell, thank you so much.
Thank you, my friend. Got to run. Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, it is the monthly visit of Nan Calvert. And with her will be Chris Litzau from the Greater Great Lakes Conservation Community Corps.
talking about some of the special projects which they are doing on behalf of the environment, including a new project in Racine to work on improved stormwater runoff. On Friday, I reconnect with Mark Cushman, who has written a new series of books about Gene Roddenberry, the creator of Star Trek, focusing specifically on the 1970s, the decade right after the original series was canceled on NBC, chronicling Roddenberry's tireless attempts to bring Star Trek back onto the air. A really, really interesting story. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack Andrea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. Their doors may be closed right now, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. And we remind you that the Morning Show is available 7 days a week as a podcast. You can search for Spotify, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, but be sure to look for